This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Fun Kids Science Weekly just got epic with brand new episodes of Thunderbird to Go on ITV and CITV every Saturday at 8 a.m.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Hello. We got a busy show today. Let's get on with it. Welcome to the Fun Kids Science Weekly. My name's Dan. Thanks so much for giving us a listen. Now, this week we're sponsored by the brand new episodes of Thunderbirds Argo. So we've got a little bit of a Thunderbirds-y theme to the science that we'll chat about. We'll talk to two space experts, proper space experts. One of them's even been up there and floated around. Also, we'll visit the smartest school outside of the solar system. I'll answer some of your questions too, and we'll chat about a deadly poison. First, let's catch up with one of our favourite, smartest Fun Kids Science experts. This is Professor Hallux.
Hallux's Hydration Help Desk. Call accepted.
Hello, Professor. So I know I'm meant to drink 8 glasses of water each day. Does it have to be water, or can I have a drink of fruit juice or a fizzy drink?
Oh, that's a good one. Now, if you're thirsty, your body will be grateful for any drink you give it, but not all drinks are the same when it comes to your health. Water is a great choice throughout the day because it hydrates without providing you with extra energy or harming your teeth.
Milk's a very useful source of nutrients, especially protein, vitamin B and calcium. You should include milk regularly in your diet, but only the stuff without sugars. Sugary milk drinks like milkshakes and hot chocolate should be an occasional treat only.
Nice smoothie, anyone? Fruit and vegetable juices and smoothies contain vitamins and minerals, and some have fibre too. However, they also contain some sugars and can be acidic too. So it's better to have no more than one a day, and then at mealtimes.
Oh, I do like a nice cup of tea.
So do I, Nanobot. Tea and coffee are fine to drink occasionally, but because they contain caffeine, they're not suitable for children in large amounts. Why not switch to the decaffeinated versions and drink with low-fat milk and no added sugar? Everyone knows that fizzy drinks and squashes contain a lot of sugar, but you might not know that even the sugar-free versions have acids that can erode the outer surface of your teeth.
And then there's sport energy drinks. While they sound healthy, they contain a massive amount of sugar and other chemicals, which really aren't suitable for children. They may even make you ill.
Any other facts for us, Nanobot?
Well, there are some very strange drinks around the world. Did you know an Indian inventor has been developing a new drink based on cow whey? Cows are sacred in India and thought to have special life-giving powers, and they reckon his drink will help keep you healthy. And if that wasn't tempting enough for you, a Chinese inventor has found a way to grow green tea in panda dung. He says his tea is both nutritious and delicious.
Gosh, well, I suppose you could enjoy a cap of panda poo tea if you really want, but I think I'll stick to water. It's fun to have a mix of drinks, even without panda poo tea, but I think water wins. It should be your first choice every time when you're filling your glass.
Hallux's Hydration Help Desk, with support from the Children's Health Fund. Find out more at funkidslive.com/hallux.
Time to answer some of your sciencey questions then. Remember, if you've got something that you urgently need the answer to, fire it over to me as a review over on Apple Podcasts, if that's how you listen to the show, and I'll sort it. Either I'll do the research and I'll explain it myself, or I'll find a proper expert in the field to tell you the answer. This is from Ben, who is 6 years old. He's from Swansea in Wales. Hey, Ben. You ask, why do fires start? Well, Ben, it's all about the famous fire triangle. The three things that flames need to burn. They need heat, they need fuel, and they need oxygen. If they've got all three of those, a fire's going to start. So you need a fuel, that's something that can burn, like wood. You need heat, something red hot, to spark the flame. And then it needs a constant source of oxygen to keep going, which is why if you cover it in water or something, it will lose the oxygen and the fire will extinguish. Thank you so much for the question, Ben. This is from Elias Dunn, who is 9 years old, who asks, why are some people ticklish and others aren't? Now, Elias, tickling is something that scientists don't 100% understand, really. There's a few thoughts on this one. Being ticklish and laughing, it might be an involuntary response, you know, like when your knee swings after the doctor's tapped it. Or maybe it could be for protection, to make you aware that something is happening around your body. And they think that that's why we're most ticklish at places where we're most vulnerable, you know, around your neck. Down your sides. And how ticklish you are depends on how aware you are of it. You know, you're far more ticklish if you're happy and you've been caught by surprise. But if you're a bit grumpy, if it's been a bad day and you know the tickling's happening, you're not really going to laugh much. Right, lastly, this is from, let's see, Thomas Wilson. Hey, Thomas, who wants to know if any animals have more than two eyes? Quite a few do, actually, Tom. The praying mantis has got five eyes, two big ones and then three tiny little ones in the middle that they use for detecting light. Some spiders have as many as 12 eyes. Most have eight and some even have none at all. And scorpions as well, they're arachnids just like spiders. So they've got two big eyes on their head, and this bit's brilliant. They've got a set of five eyes lining each side of their body. So they've got 12 eyes in all, scorpions. Lovely, thank you for that question. Something nice and silly to end that part of the show on. If you've got something that you really need answered, a sciencey question, leave it for me as a review over on Apple Podcasts. So I thought we'd get like a proper space expert to come on and to answer some of your questions. And we've got Keir Boxall. He's worked with NASA. Keir, thank you so much for coming on the Fun Kid Science Weekly. And we've got a load of questions in. They've been sent in to us by this app called PopJam. The first one is by Tinkerbell123. The names get better. Who asks, what is a meteorite made out of?
Hi, Tinkerbell. A meteorite is made from mainly rock and iron.
Yeah. And how does it form? How does it get put together? So there's this rock, there's this iron. Is it just floating around the galaxy? How does it end up as a meteorite?
So it's left over from how the solar system was formed. So you get dust particles basically coalesce together in space, forming larger and larger particles. And then eventually they form a spinning disk, and that's how a solar system is formed. And then they start to, the gravity crushes them and they get really, really hot and they start to melt together. And then they bash into each other and they break up, and there's this big cycle of things spinning around, bashing into each other and breaking up. And then there's the asteroid belt is left as a vestige of that process in our solar system. And that, so they all basically come from the asteroid belt.
So why do they form, though? What is it going on between these sparse items that draws them towards each other?
It's gravity. Yeah, so every particle has mass, and so if you have mass, then you create a gravitational field, even though it's tiny. So the forces that we're used to dealing with, so your phone and that water bottle, the attraction between those that there is, that's the gravitational attraction between them is minute compared to the gravitational pull of the Earth, which is huge, which is very, very massive.
So that we've got this water bottle in front of me. What's stopping it from being sucked into my hand and never being let go?
Because the Earth is much, much bigger than you, and the Earth is pulling it down to the ground.
So if there was no gravity from the Earth, just for say, everything would be stuck to each other all the time?
If you and the bottle were in space, then you would be slowly drifting towards each other, yeah. But the force, it's an inverse relationship. So the further away from another massive object you are, the exponentially smaller the force is that pulls them together. But that force will always be there. It doesn't disappear.
This question is from Talking Machine over on Pop Jam, who asks, how big is space?
That's a great question. So it depends how you're defining space. So if you define space as, if you're thinking of space as the universe, which is what we look at when it's nighttime, then we call that the observable universe. So we can only see the light basically that's coming from other things in the universe, and that's about, it's a little bit over 90 billion light years across.
So does that mean it takes 90 billion years for light to travel from the furthest point that we can see to our eyes?
Well, that it's a diameter, you know, so it's kind of 45 billion years to the edge of space. But yeah, if you were on one side of space of the universe and you were looking at the other side of the universe, it would take more than 90 billion years for the light to get to your eyes.
And if you take into account everything, not just the discoverable universe that we can see, but everything that exists out there, do we have any idea how big that might be?
So they think that, when the Big Bang occurred, space rushed out first and then protons, so then light rushed out afterwards along that space-time continuum. And so what we can see as the edge of the universe is, that 90-odd billion light-year diameter. And then beyond that, space is a quadrillion times larger, which is one with 24 zeros after it. It's very, very big.
You said that after the Big Bang, space rushed out first.
Yeah.
What does that mean? So just nothingness, more nothingness rushed out first?
Yeah, basically, yeah. So I wondered whether you might ask me. So the universe is only 13.8 billion years old, and nothing travels faster than light.
Only, yeah.
Yeah, so, or that we know of yet. And so if it's over 90 billion years old and it's only 13.8 billion years old and 90 billion light years across, doesn't that mean that light has travelled faster? Because those two numbers, it should only be able to be 26 billion light years across, if you see what I mean.
I do. Well, this is a question from Elodie 12 Dancer, who asks, what would happen if we didn't have space? The answer may be nothing.
Yeah, so that's a difficult question to answer. So if we're talking about if we didn't have the universe, then we basically can't exist without space and without the universe, because we exist in it. So if it wasn't there, we wouldn't be here either. But if you're talking about the universe, then things would just get gradually colder and nighttime would be quite boring because we wouldn't be able to see all those stars.
Staying up there just for a second, this is from Sarah and Matthew, who are in Abu Dhabi, who asks, is there an end to the universe? What do we know is at the end of the universe?
Well, so we know that there's this wave of... So you can think of it, the Big Bang, a little bit like, dropping a droplet in a lake, or in a puddle. So there's this ripple that's going out from that first Big Bang. And
is it slowing down, the ripple?
It's speeding up, actually. So the universe is getting... is expanding and getting further apart.
Wow.
So there's a force that was created in the Big Bang that's pushing everything outwards. So there's an end to the observable universe. So that's that 90 billion. Mm-hmm. And then that quadrillion times larger bit is, so yes, there's an end to space as we know it, but we have no idea what's beyond it, and which is... a great, still unanswered question.
It just baffles me.
And me.
It's that all this goes on, there's so many geniuses, the smartest people that have ever lived, have constantly been racking their brains with that question. There's been so much money just pumped into this question as well, and we still don't know. The best, I don't know if you can say that this is true, I once heard a description of the universe as it being like blowing up a balloon. So just everything is getting bigger. Is that kind of what's going on?
Yep. Yeah, that is kind of exactly what's going on. Yeah, or like a bubble expanding. So if you blew a bubble, under the sea, and it would get bigger and bigger as it went up. You can think of the universe like that. Yeah.
One last one. This is from me, because I know, Keir, you're really interested in nanotech. How is tiny bits of technology going to help us explore the universe in the future?
Wow, just in so many ways. So most of what we call nanotechnology right now is really in the materials space. And what I mean by that is if you make a nanostructure in a material, you can tailor the properties of it. So if you want something that's really, really strong and really light, then making these nano size, so one billionth of a millimeter sized geometries within it will allow you to get to making something much stronger or much lighter or much more electrically conductive. So and space is extremely harsh environment. So the satellites that are going around the Earth, as they pass from the sun into the shade, they have a swing of about 400 degrees Celsius. So it goes from plus 200 in the sun to minus 200 in the shade, which is, you know, so it's an incredibly harsh environment. There's tons of radiation out there. So the materials piece and protecting ourselves and our systems from that radiation and the cold and meteorites and everything else is going to be a big way that nanotechnology will help us. But you could also envisage sending out, you know, a fleet of tiny spaceships, essentially, that are sensors, you know, so that you could make actual readings. Because most of what we have to do when we're discovering space right now is, you know, essentially look through a telescope, you know, because everything's so far away. So I quite like the idea of sending out millions of tiny spaceships in every direction.
Keir Boxall, thank you so much for coming on the Fun Kids Science Weekly. If you've got a question that you want us to get a proper expert on the show to answer, leave it to me as a comment on the iTunes podcast store. Let's do this week's Dangerous Dan then, where we talk about some of the most mean and evil things in the world. And today, we've got a classic poison. Arsenic is naturally occurring across the world. It's an element with the atomic number 33. It's found in the Earth's crust, in air, in water, and on land. And it can be used, quite helpfully, to treat wood. It's used in pesticides. It's even found in volcanic ash. And it's also pretty deadly. Long-term exposure to arsenic changes the way that cells communicate. It reduces their ability to work in the body. Scientists also think that it plays a role in all kinds of diseases that you can get, and arsenic is sneaky. Over time, it'll cause a range of symptoms. They kind of build up without you realising. It'll then cause vomiting, diarrhoea, bleeding, loads of pain, and finally, even death. Now, time travelling for just a second, back in the Victorian era, so a couple of hundred years ago, arsenic, it was a poison used quite readily by women, actually, mostly, because they could find it easily, and then they could use it to see off their husbands. And there's been quite a lot of gruesome cases from back then of this very thing happening, being poisoned by arsenic. Now, today, it's not really used much by people, but by nature, quite a lot. In some parts of the world, scientists think that water contains way too much arsenic, like a hugely deadly amount. And that's why it's there, deathly. Arsenic shoots straight to the top of our Dangerous Dan list.
On the Fun Kids website this week, there's a brand new series all about the Internet of Things. Technomum is going to be telling us all about how your iPad talks to your car, or your house, or your body. Plus, there's a chance to win a nature kit, an Amazon smart speaker, and loads more. Just visit funkidslive.com on your computer, phone, or tablet.
Now, it's a Thunderbirds Argo special of the Fun Kids Science Weekly, and because the Thunderbirds love their space, let's head there ourselves and get a lesson from Professor Pulsar.
Deep Space High, Spaceports.
Okay, everyone at Deep Space High, I'm ready to transmit my presentation on spaceports. You're gonna love it. Transmitting in 3, 2, 1. So, spaceports are basically a lot like airports, where craft like space planes and rockets take off and land. Since the development of spaceflight on Earth, virtually all spacecraft have been launched vertically using rockets supported by giant gantries which fall away as the rocket takes off. That's certainly one way to get a payload in space, but it's probably not going to be the only way you would see at a future spaceport. Rocket gantries need massive amounts of engineering, both above and below the ground, to be really strong. And because rockets need a large amount of propulsion to launch, you need a large exclusion area around the gantry to keep people safe. The closest people to a space shuttle launch were the emergency crews, and they were still over a mile away. There's a proposal to build spaceports in the UK to launch both rockets vertically and space planes that take off horizontally, using long runways, just like normal planes. One reason to use runways for horizontal takeoffs is that we already have airports set up for this, or at least ones that could be easily converted. That means spaceports could be up and running more quickly and more cheaply. And cost is important because the first people using British spaceports are likely to be companies sending small satellites up. It won't necessarily be people with a lot of money for their very own massive rockets. So how much runway might you need to launch a space plane? Not much more than for a regular aircraft, at least on the ground. The minimum length required for space planes is 3,000 metres. One of the largest is at Cape Canaveral, and it is over 4,500 metres in length. Once in the air, the safest flight paths are ones that don't go over places where people are living. This is why people are suggesting that spaceports should be near to the coast, so space planes and rockets can take off over the sea. So how does a space plane launch? Ultimately, they'll take off and land like normal planes, just like you see on Star Wars and science fiction movies. Imagine what they might look like in the future. But that technology doesn't currently exist, and so for the foreseeable future, space planes need a piggyback from more conventional-looking planes, like Virgin Galactic's White Knight 2. This climbs to 16 kilometres, where it releases Spaceship 2 and returns to Earth. Once released, Spaceship 2, the reusable winged spacecraft that can carry 8 people into space, ignites its own rockets to climb up to 110 kilometres in space. The design of Spaceship 2's wings helps it to decelerate gently and land very accurately. It also doesn't need as much thermal protection as other craft. But like with airports, there's more to spaceports than just long runways for takeoff and landing. Think maintenance, freight, and of course passengers. You might also need training facilities for astronauts, and also a cool control tower to make sure every takeoff and landing is safe. Uh-oh, losing the connection. Catch you next time.
Deep Space High. Spaceports. With support from the UK Space Agency. Find out more at funkidslive.com/space.
Get this, right, on the phone is one of the most accomplished astronauts in the world. He's been the director of NASA operations, he was chief of robotics, he was the commander of the International Space Station. It's Chris Hadfield.
Hello, Dan. How are you?
How are you? Yeah, you're not in space right now, though, are you?
Well, I'm down here on the surface of the Earth with you. But yeah, I've been in space 3 times. I flew 3 different rocket ships, and I lived off of Earth for half a year.
It just blows my mind. So I've been thinking, right, the universe is obviously a massive place. So I'm going to start with a massive question.
All right.
What is the best thing about being in space?
Seeing the whole world every 90 minutes. You go around, imagine if you could go around the world 16 times today, where you could be here in London and 45 minutes later, you could be over Australia. And then 45 minutes later, you're back and see the whole world until you get to know it like your backyard. It's an amazing privilege. The universe is massive, as you say, but boy, you never see the world like you see it from space.
So what's the worst thing about being in space?
The food, maybe. We have no oven, no microwave, no refrigerator, no freezer. So that it's sort of like being on an eternal camping trip where you have to fend for yourself. It's not bad. It's healthy. But it's nice to have good, fresh food when you get home.
So tell me, what do you have in the morning then? First thing you wake up, what's for breakfast?
Dehydrated scrambled eggs, powdered milk on granola. Sometimes we have like a beef jerky or something in place of, you know, bacon to go with your scrambled eggs. Reconstituted orange juice and then maybe an instant coffee. Not great, but good enough.
Talk to me about your very first trip into space. You've trained for so long. You're finally the astronaut. You're sat in the rocket, ready to blast off into space. What are you thinking?
I decided to be an astronaut when I was 9 years old. I decided I'm going to grow up to be something. Why don't I grow up to be that? And so to then be in the rocket 26 years later, lying on my back with my... with my belly button pointed at the universe, thinking about the road that got me there, but also all the stuff that's about to happen. And you aren't a passenger on a rocket ship. You drive it. You're very much involved with it. So mostly what you're thinking about is how to successfully steer and pilot this rocket ship up to space. It's a very dangerous, complicated thing. But part of you is also that same nine-year-old boy, nine-year-old kid, sort of running around the cockpit with your hands up over your head, excited that, wow, this is really happening today. You sort of have both those people inside you at once.
Where were you going?
On my first flight, we were going to help build an earlier space station, the Russian space station, which they called Mir, which is the Russian word for peace, also the Russian word for the world. So they called their first space station the world. And I helped build it on my first space flight.
Now, we've all been on roller coasters, like traveled pretty fast in a car as well. Tell me about the difference, just what's going on in your body as you're catapulted up into the sky, pushed by fire and gas. What's going on?
It's an enormously powerful series of explosions that's pushed you to space. It's crazy, the amount of force and power. And it's a little bit like a roller coaster or an immensely powerful car. But maybe it's more as if, imagine if instead of sitting upright in a chair, you tip the chair over backwards. So now you're lying on your back with your feet sort of up on a chair. And then more and more people start piling on top of you. And as they're piling on top of you, someone is jumping up and down on top of the stack of people so that you have the weight and you have the vibration and you have the weird position. All of that's going on, but you have to ignore it all because you're flying a spaceship and things go wrong all the time. So you somehow have to ignore this great oppressive weight on your chest and all the vibration and shaking of the power of the vehicle and somehow focus on the things that really matter. And it only takes 9 minutes, but it is an extremely demanding 9 minutes, one that I trained my whole life for.
Earlier on, I listed all of your accomplishments, you know, astronaut, director.
All of them?
Well, I listed quite a few of them, I'd hope, but okay. We need to add one more now. You're a kids author. You've got your first kids book out, and it's the phrase amongst authors is write what you know, and that's what you've done. Tell me about The Darkest Dark.
When I was little, I lived out in the countryside on a farm, and it was a big old house that would creak in the night with the wind. And we had horses, and I had to walk out to the barns when it was dark and climb up into where the hay was stored, up into the hay mow. A small, terrified little person crawling up into the complete darkness of the hay mow where anything could be lurking in the dark. And I was scared like anyone would be. I mean, it's normal to be scared of the dark. But I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to think of how you learn to be brave in the dark? And the fact that the dark is where you dream. And the dark is where you get ready for the morning and think about all the stuff you're going to do during the day. And that's what the book is. The book is called The Darkest Dark. And I even wrote a song about it, The Darkest Dark. But the idea of the book is it's okay to be afraid, but your life really occurs in how you find ways to be brave and how you find ways to not let fear keep you from doing the things that you're dreaming of. And that's what's in The Darkest Dark.
You've made a song for the book because one of the things that you're best known for as an astronaut on Earth is obviously you made the video, David Bowie's Space Oddity, got 33 million views now of you playing your guitar on the ISS. How long did that take you to prepare?
Oh, I've been a musician my whole life. I bought a guitar with my brother, a very inexpensive guitar, when we were about 10 or 11.
But you're not a director, though, and some of the shots on that video, Spielberg-like.
Well, I've always played music and played with friends and bands, and a lot when I got to the space station on my third space flight, I was writing music and recording music, and a lot of people started saying, hey, if you could, do a cover of Space Oddity, that iconic David Bowie song. And so it took about 2 hours. I sang it, and then once I'd sung it and some friends had put instrumentals, then I just, one afternoon, I floated around the space station and filmed myself singing the song. And I did it all by myself, just me and a weightless floating camera. And then I sent it down to my son, Evan, who took the audio and then the video, and he put it all together. And as you say, just the one site where my son Evan put that video up, it's been seen many, many millions of times. And beyond that, hundreds of millions of times in a lot of other places. So it's pretty incredible how music and art can help us see a place maybe more clearly and differently.
Chris, we've got about a minute left. So obviously the bravest guy I know and I've ever spoken to, but are you ready for your most intimidating challenge yet?
I think so.
Questions from the Fun Kids listeners.
Go for it.
We've got a few through the Kids App Pop Jam. This is from 3_CraftyCats, who says, did you bring your phone?
I could phone people from space, but a regular cell phone won't work because you're so high and going so fast.
This is from Princess Grace 20, who says, how do you brush your teeth?
Brushing is the same, but there's no sink and no running water, so at the end, you have to swallow the toothpaste.
This is from, interesting, from Javez021. Is the time different over there?
You go around the world 16 times a day, so what time is it? But in fact, we choose London time, just oddly enough. We live on Greenwich time on the space station. When the Queen wakes up, we wake up.
Lovely GMT. Finally, from Marky Mark 1, are there such things as aliens?
We haven't found any yet, but we're looking. We're driving around Mars. We're looking with our telescopes. There seems to be an unlimited number of planets, like a septillion planets. So probably there's life. But so far, we're the only life we know.
Chris, thank you so much. The Darkest Dark is out right now. It's by Commander Chris Hadfield. Thanks so much for coming on Fun Kids.
Thanks, Dan. Nice to talk with you. And nice to talk with everybody.
Let's do this week's Science in the News. The future of the critically endangered Sumatran rhino has been struck a blow as the last male in Malaysia has died. They once roamed freely across Asia, but now fewer than 100 exist. Deforestation and poaching, it's been awful for them, taking their horns and their land. And a terrible news, because Tam, who was the last male, he lived in a wildlife reserve over in Borneo, and he's now died. Also, scientists are calling for volunteers to help spot insect spit all around the UK. Blobs of frothy foam on a plant, it's a sign that an insect known as the spittlebug is feeding on the plant. The information gained by volunteers, it could be you, you could help this. It will be used to map where all the insects are, and it will try and save the plants from a deadly disease. And finally, this is a nice Thunderbird's Argo one. SpaceX company has begun rolling out its orbiting broadband system. A Falcon 9 rocket launched in Florida last week. It was packed with 60 satellites capable of giving people all across the world access to high-speed internet. Broadband, do you think it's a brilliant idea, or is it more like a Bond villain invention? I think I'll let you decide on that one. And that is it for this episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. It's been sponsored by brand new episodes of Thunderbirds Argo. They're on ITV and CITV Saturday morning at 8 o'clock. If you've enjoyed it, if you want to hear more of our science series, you can. We've got some of the ones that you've heard today, more of them, loads, tons more as well, over on Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your shows from. It's on the free Fun Kids app and at funkidslive.com. If Apple Podcasts is how you listen to us, by the way, make sure you find the Fun Kids Science Weekly on there and leave us a review in the comment box at the bottom. Drop me your science question and I'll find the answer for you. And you can always listen to Fun Kids. We're a children's radio station from the UK. You can hear us all over the country on your DAB digital radio, on that free Fun Kids app, and as always at funkidslive.com.
Fun Kids Science Weekly just got epic, with brand new episodes of Thunderbirds A Go on ITV and CITV every Saturday at 8 a.m.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
So that was a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.